Willingness to get an operating agreement is a sign that you really believe and you're really treating your business as a business.
Get an operating agreement set up as soon as you can, certainly if you're bringing on partners. Because if you didn't do an operating agreement or you have a single member operating agreement and you're bringing on a partner, 99 times out of 100, that document does not cover everything it needs to cover and does not protect both people.
Less stress, more time, more money. Welcome to the Cashflow Contractor interview.
Martin, we've got a thrilling episode on legal agreements that everyone is always preemptive on, just thinking about first thing when they start a business. They're like, man, I really need to speak to an attorney because they're just going to help me out. And I just want to spend several hours with them, chit-chatting, paying an hourly rate. We'll have some good conversations about this coming up. But I want to hear how you met Patrick.
I rode bicycles with one of Patrick's partners, and so kind of became aware of the law firm. Then I don't know, maybe a year or two later, I had an issue that I had worried about for a long time. Patrick's probably smiling, thinking you were worried about that. Well, yeah, I was, and I thought it was going to drag out and cause a lot of problems, and I stressed over it. Called him up, and he fixed it like, I don't know if it was the same day, but I mean, it was a morning and an after. The other side had had an attorney call me, right? Their attorney. And I know I never liked that, right? Anyway, Patrick handled it like in a few minutes and very, very, I remember what I paid and it wasn't very much. I was going, oh, okay. So a lot of these things I do worry about, like, or that cross our paths, you know, some legal issue, or can I just handle that, or should I talk to an attorney? You know, yeah, you can talk to an attorney and get it off your plate and quit trying to be the lawyer. So right. Anyway, that's how I met Patrick. And then I've referred you to, I'm looking at Patrick. I referred him to, I don't know, a number of clients, and he's always taken care of them. And that's a big deal with me. If I refer somebody, I don't want to hear that they never called back or they, anyway. So he continues to get my referrals as recently as maybe a month ago. I don't know. Yeah. So
that's great.
Anyway, that's how I know Patrick.
Well, great. Well, welcome to the podcast, Patrick. We're glad to have you.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. And I don't want Martin to set expectations improperly. His experience is not what everybody's experience is. I don't have problems.
Go see Patrick. He's going to knock it out in three minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great.
That one worked out well and quick, but they're not all that way.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, you know, we've talked legal on the podcast before. It's been quite a while. And when we're not with an actual attorney and we're just talking together, me and Martin, or mentioning anything legal related, we know that in every listener's mind, there's this stigma of like, it's going to cost a fortune. I'm not going to understand it. I'm going to be stuck talking to an attorney forever, maybe. There's a lot of stigmas around it. But one thing that we've talked about before, Martin, is just operating agreements and the importance of them. I know that this is one episode that you really wanted, Martin. Maybe let's give listeners a backdrop to why we think this is so important, what kind of spurred this on for us.
Agreements are like insurance policies. They're kind of a pain in the rear. You got something you got to mess with and you're not really that interested until you need them. But then when you need them, it's like, oh my God, right? So operating agreements, in my experience, a great number of companies do not have an operating agreement. We'll let Patrick talk about when it's necessary. He said, if there's a single member, if you're the sole owner, maybe you don't need it. But whenever you bring somebody in who has rights other than just, I use the word partnership, but maybe not strictly a partnership, whenever you bring somebody in, even if they're a minority, well, I'm the boss, I got all the power, and I'm not going to be a lawyer here, but you might have the majority, you might have 90%, and you think you can do whatever you want, whenever you want. And I'm just know that that's not exactly true. People still have rights, even if it's only 10%. I don't know where the line is, but so whenever you bring people in who are not easily dismissed, or not at will employees, that kind of thing, I think you need an understanding of what your relationship is. And when you get with the right person, and I think Patrick's one of them, it even goes beyond that. you need to ask a lot of really hard questions early on before money and emotions enter the equation. Like who's the boss and how do you decide? I'll let Patrick talk about these things, but how do you decide issues? If you need to put money in, you can and I can't. What happens my spouse divorces me and she gets my shares in the company? Do you have a new? Anyway, all those things. And to find a good attorney who can walk you through those questions before you commit is just gold. Yeah. And did that answer the question, Cleo?
That does. That's really why.
So,
Patrick, I want to hear from you. People come to you for an operating agreement. Obviously, maybe more sophisticated people are doing it at the front end, but when is the typical timeline that someone's coming to you on, and is it sometimes too late?
Oh, sure. that does happen. More recently, banks are almost universally requiring an operating agreement to open a business checking account. And so even the single member LLC is probably going to have an operating agreement. They're not technically required under the law to create a company. You only really need the articles of organization. You file with the Secretary of State, and then your company is active. But the operating agreement the best analogy that I've come up with is kind of like the Constitution, right? And so the Constitution does not have every single law that governs the people in this country, right? It has some level really important ones. And that is similar to what an operating agreement functions as. It has who the manager is, where's the principal place of business. There is typically a purpose section. What's the purpose of the company? Generally speaking, most people give the generic any lawful business type description for purpose, but there are circumstances where you want a specific purpose stated in the operating agreement. But other than that, and we can get into some of those provisions in more detail, but banks want the operating agreement so that they know who they're supposed to be dealing with. Accountants want an operating agreement because it defines the tax treatment. And so are we, for a sole member, is this just a pass-through, or are we going to set it up as an S-corp and file its own tax returns? And so there are a lot of external players who may require even a single member to have an operating agreement, whether they want to or not. The time that you really need one is if you're bringing on a partner. A single member, when it's just you and you own 100% of the company, it's more of a formality, typically, like I said, for banks. But the real, kind of rubber hitting the road and you need an operating agreement is when you're bringing on a partner.
I'm sure you would probably need one if you were thinking of doing some sort of like profit share program with your employees or something like that. Probably make a lot of sense in those cases, just in case like, well, we weren't profitable because I took 50% of the profits out as draws. And so,
even that is more a separate document.
Okay.
Because the operating agreement is going to give profit and loss allocation for tax purposes type guidance, but your employees aren't co-owners, and the operating agreement is really a document for the ownership of the company.
Gotcha. So let's cover some of the things. You mentioned tax already. What are some of the things that are covered in a multi-member? We've got, three of us in a partnership or two of us in a partnership. What are the biggest provisions that are going to be inside of those operating agreements?
Well, biggest in terms of most important, or biggest in terms of covers the most pages, because those are not always
no
the same,
maybe but. Even the biggest, like most important and overlooked and even not thought about.
So one of the biggest, if you're bringing on co-owners and you're going to split things 50-50, which is very often the case, you and your friend decide you're going to start this business, you're both going to pour in the same amount of money, there should always, in that situation where we're doing this together and we're going to split everything, be a deadlock, gridlock type provision where if we can't agree on what to do, this is how we're going to handle it. We're going to, and there's lots of ways. You can designate a board of advisors in the operating agreement and say, all right, well, Martin and Khalil are partners. They know that there may come a time where they're not going to agree on a step to take for the business. And so in the operating agreement, we're going to say Patrick, Parker, and Zach are the board of three, and what they decide on this, whatever issue we submit to them, is how we're going to handle it. We typically don't recommend having named board of advisors. It's a situation where in a 50-50, Martin chooses somebody in the particular gridlock, and Khalil chooses somebody, and then those two people choose a third person to kind of be the tiebreaker. And that's usually how we set up those types of provisions, so that, you know, what if I don't want to be on your on your board of advisors right. in any particular situation? So that's a big one that a lot of people don't think about when they're, because when you're getting started, everything's great. We're excited about this business we're going to start, you know, and then, oh, well, I want to do this. Well, I don't want to do this. And then, you know, the business can operate still, but it could, for development purposes and growth, come to a just screeching halt if neither of you can concede or compromise on whatever that particular issue is.
What's your recommendation in terms of like that percentage ownership? Is 50-50 split recommended from you? Or do you recommend, if people are willing to change that, do you recommend that they change it?
My recommendation typically depends on who I'm representing. Okay. And so,
you want to be with the majority owner.
Yeah. If I'm representing somebody who's put in the most money or put in and is going to be running the company versus a silent investor type person, you know, if it's your business and you're just needing some financial infusion, then yeah, I'd want my client in that situation to have the majority vote so that they can continue to operate their business. And a lot of this morphs and the advice changes as businesses grow, you know, or private equity is brought in. And so this, a lot of the conversation that we're having is for small business type situations. So yeah, I want to make that clear. But very often we get the 50-50 deal, and part of, I think, the value in what seeking counsel at the outset brings is, you know, I oversee our transactional and our litigation group. And so in addition to drafting the documents, I've also fought in court over these documents. And so I have that background that I can ask questions because I've seen it play out with other clients, you know, and people don't think about it. People don't think about, what if we disagree? We're best friends and we're going to start this business. It's not going to happen. We're going to agree on everything. And that's rarely the case.
So how does that play out? Can you give us some examples of, like, in the litigation, it was 50-50, the agreement sucked, it wasn't clear. What does it look like? How does that pan out long-term? What does it cost the business owner long-term? What is it a resolve in finally?
I mean, generally speaking, it is a drawn out legal battle where, depending on the type of business, there might be a third party appointed to run the business because you two can't agree. Because one of the legal factors for whether you're going to dissolve a business is if it's impracticable to carry on the business. And if the two owners can't agree on anything and now hate each other, that box is checked. And so you can go into court and ask the judge to appoint what's called a receiver or a conservator. And then that person will either run it until you guys can work out a deal, or they'll just sell everything off and liquidate it. But they get paid the whole time. They have an attorney that gets paid. You're paying your attorneys. It's a very expensive process.
Right.
Whereas if they just go and get an operating agreement up front, I mean, no more than
one thing about getting that operating agreement up front is that you might not do the partnership deal. I mean, that very clearly, you need to find that out early. So, that's a deadlock breaker. What are some of the other things that an operating agreement should deal with?
The big one is management. And so that is a lot of things. So generally speaking, limited liability companies are either managed by all the members. And so each member has the authority to act on behalf of the company and bind the company and whatnot, or you select a manager. And the manager is who kind of makes the decisions for the company. And so that's a manager managed LLC. And that's what we recommend, for efficiency, for, best practices, because in a situation where it's member managed and you've got three members, any of them can go, you know, commit the company to debt or make decisions that you would really want to, if it's a big decision, have some sort of meeting or vote on. And so we recommend a manager managed. Typically in the operating agreements, the manager is designated or will be designated shortly after the company's formed. And then within the operating agreement as well, you can set kind of the limitations on what the manager can do without getting everybody's approval, and then what has to get everybody's approval. And that fluctuates wildly depending on what kind of business you're in.
I have to, Cleo, you like stories. I'm thinking of a former client, had three partners.
I was going to bring this up.
Two of them were on the same page and one wasn't. And the one who wasn't bought a company over the weekend and exhausted the company's cash, not by paying a fraction of it, but completely unbeknownst to anybody. And he knew it was unbeknownst to him, and it was screw you, and I'm going to do it. And he did it and came in, and the bank was empty, and they had a new what? So anyway, no way to unwrap that deal.
There was a lot more to it than that. He had part ownership in that company they acquired.
Okay.
Yeah. So I remember that.
That's
vividly,
problematic.
Because I was like, what in the world?
Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty nuts. And then it was a really pretty solid company for years, and then everything just dissolved, just fell apart. And I mean, worth multi-millions.
Yeah, gone.
So really unfortunate.
When you do have, I mean, everybody wants to say 50-50 because they want to make their good buddy mad, which right there, you need to figure that out. Mm-hmm. But if you go 50-50 and you go the management route, some single manager route, the preferred route, do they just have to agree? I mean, do you find that's really hard, or are people generally amenable to that? Not everybody wants to be the manager.
Right. And it's circumstantial in whether or not they're running the business together, or one of them's running it and the other one is financing it. There's a lot of nuances to that, which is why in the operating agreements, you want to really articulate in somewhat broad strokes what the manager can do. So a lot of operating agreements have a spending cap on manager authority. If it's above X amount of dollars, the manager has to get everybody's approval or a majority approval to spend the money or take out the loan or what have you. And like I said, that threshold is very different from industry to industry. It's, you know, if you're in the oil and gas industry, that can be very high. If you're starting a service company of any kind, it can be a much smaller number. So,
yeah.
And that helps those situations where you agreed, I can spend $5,000 without coming and talking to you. So I went and bought this piece of equipment, and then the other member has to say, yeah, you're right. But, maybe we need, and then at that point, maybe you need to look at amending the operating agreement saying, I'm not as comfortable with you having a $5,000 carte blanche blank check as I thought I was. Let's bring that down. Or what is more often the case, business grows, we're buying more expensive stuff. We need to up that so that every time the manager needs a piece of equipment. He's not having to get everybody on an email chain approving it, because most of those above the threshold decisions require some sort of written consent from the members. And so there's some administrative headache, depending on where you set these management boundaries, that you've really got to think about.
I think for most of our listeners that could be in a partnership, that's kind of one of two ways. It's either them and one other person, or a couple other people have decided that they're going to start their contracting business together. The other way would maybe that they needed an investor that they knew had experience or whatever, and so they would bring them on in this case. But that's probably the main two. Obviously, there's probably other circumstances, but that's going to cover a majority of them. And it's more likely that first one of, hey, we were in a company together back in the day, let's go and let's start our own thing. That's usually what I've seen from our listeners. So we can kind of focus on that aspect of it. I think one question I had for you is, if we're starting that partnership, is it best for us to each have our own attorney going into the operating agreement, or no, let's all go together? Obviously, maybe with the investor one, I would say yes, maybe get your own attorney and make sure that they're reviewed. Maybe the investor is more savvy legally than you are because they have experience in this. And so then they create the operating agreement, get that reviewed by an attorney. Don't just sign it. But yeah, what's your advice there?
So it's a question for me on the ethical side of making sure that I'm not representing people with competing interests. And so we always get advise people to have their own counsel. You know, if two people are coming to us and asking us to draft it, you know, we make clear to them, we are drafting this. We don't represent either of you against the other, but each of you in that scenario should get your own attorney to look at it. Or, you know, Joe asked me to prepare this operating agreement. I'm representing Joe in this.
Yeah.
You know, and Stan, you need to go get your own attorney to review it. And so definitely the recommendation is always, even in a 50-50 where technically that everything should be the same for both partners, each person should have somebody who's looking out for their interests alone review the document. That's not always super exciting to hear when you're just starting a company that's not generating revenue yet, but it's really the best practice is to jointly have the operating agreement drafted by an attorney. You should each have another attorney look at it, or, you know, one has the attorney draft it and then the other one has their own attorney review it and okay it. That should happen every time. I will tell you from experience, it usually does not.
Well, that's the ideal scenario. So I want to talk about some of the other things that I've heard, that should be a part of the management, I would assume, but what happens in the case of credit card payments and draws and distributions? And like, I've seen people pay off personal cards from the company and then the other person's pissed. Then there's like, what happens if there's a divorce from one of the family or one of the partners gets a divorce? What happens with the wife or the husband, the spouse? Do they get ownership now? What are your thoughts there?
There's a lot packed into what you just asked me.
How about you deal with cash and contributions and taking money out?
Start there. Yeah, let's start there.
So the operating agreement will typically have a distribution section. And by and large, absent some other agreement, the distributions are supposed to be made pro rata to the ownership, right? And it's not uncommon for that provision to be amended to where, you know, somebody like who started it and brings on a partner, well, I've got a bunch of equity in this. I'm not going to make you buy into the company, but the ownership distributions are going to be uneven until, you know, this financial threshold or whatever. So it's not uncommon to have that, but the standard provision is distributions are pro rata based on your ownership. So if it's 60-40, that's how we distribute it. And then whether distributions are discretionary or mandatory is another piece of that puzzle. You know, you don't want to have mandatory distributions for a company that doesn't have the money to distribute. So a lot of the times, especially in the early phases, those are discretionary. But in the situation that you're talking about, in that situation, and then kind of the inverse, there can be equalizer provisions where, okay, we paid off a credit card or you paid off your own credit card. That's going to be booked as a distribution. And then the cash coming out for distributions when that happens is going to be unequal because you received that benefit. Generally speaking, I would say that somebody paying off a personal debt out of company funds without everybody's approval is very problematic.
I've got another client you need to call who does forensic accounting.
Yeah, that
it's a sign.
Yeah, if it's a one-off and you can fix it with altering the next distribution out of the company, that is great and optimal. Generally speaking,
that's when you want to work with.
Yeah, and typically that snowballs pretty quick into bigger expenditures for personal benefit. Yeah. But yeah.
You know, sometimes one thing on the distributions that I see come up, and it's worth mentioning, I think, is a lot of these companies are pass-through organizations. So if they make money, the owners have to pay their share of the taxes on the profit. And one owner might have a lot of cash, not want to do any distributions and leave it in the company to grow. The other one doesn't have the cash to pay the taxes. So a lot of times you'll see, or I'm aware of, I don't know if it's a lot of times, provisions that say we will make a tax distribution. And of course, their taxes might not be the same. I mean, even proportionately, they might not be the same because other. So some level that we will pay this amount of, we'll distribute this much toward taxes. Might be enough, might not, but we'll do it.
Yeah. Right? And those provisions are typically discretionary, not mandatory, kind of left to the manager or the vote of the members. And the tax provisions of operating agreements can get very involved, which is why, you know, in addition to somebody like me, you really want to bring your CPA in at the ground level. Certainly for bringing on a partner or starting a multi-member company, because, you know, the default for anything in a multi-member company is you're going to be taxed as a partnership. But depending on the circumstances of the company and the industry and the individuals who own it, maybe you want to be taxed as an S corp. And I don't know that. That's why, you know, I try to stay in my lane as much as I can, and not what I just said is about as far as I go on tax speak at all, because the CPAs are the experts in that, and I would defer to them every time. And they need to be involved in the conversation when you're starting a business. Mm.
Another one that I think is important, you know, you have that, circumstance we just spoke about where the person's paying off their personal credit cards with company money, all that kind of stuff. You obviously want to remove them from the partnership, but what does that exit provision look like? I don't know if that's what you would term it, but how does that work? And what should you outline in the operating agreement for that?
Well, and that's a good question, because a lot of the times there are some states who have expulsion provisions in their Limited Liability Company Act. Oklahoma does not have a statute specifically saying if a member does this, you can for sure kick them out. Most of the operating agreements I've seen and drafted don't provide that. And it's because the you don't want to be on the wrong side of that. If right. You're, you know, if you're being a good person and you don't want a majority of the members to come in and be like, well, you know, Patrick sucks and we don't like him anymore, like, let's expel him. And generally speaking, you got to do something wrong. So that the scenario not very common. And so in our practice, we recommend handling stuff like that in the buy sell agreement, which we think everybody should have that has partners, which would handle the divorce question that you asked about earlier. Mm. And there are lots of operating agreements that I've seen that have these buy sell provisions built into the operating agreement. We feel like the mechanics of it, you know, because there's valuations, there's the triggering events for the buy sell, such as death or divorce or incapacitation, you know, okay. God forbid if you develop Alzheimer's or get in a wreck or something like that. And so we advise clients that having a separate document that is, you know, agreed to by all the members under the voting terms of an operating agreement, but is its own contract between everybody, is a better practice because it's focused on that scenario of what happens in these situations to somebody else's ownership. And 9 times out of 10, that's a very easy sell, so to speak, for me, because most of the people that we have partnering up are married, and most of them want to be partners with each other, but not necessarily the spouses of who they're partnering with. And not, that's not a, you know, any sort of indictment on the spouses or anything like that. It's just, you're not who I partnered with. And so, and I've got, you know, I've had litigation on buy sells where the insurance policies weren't done properly that fund the buy sell. And then one partner dies and the other partner thought this insurance policy was going to pay the widow for the ownership in the company. And she says, yeah, I don't think this is enough, but the money's going to her and he can't stop it. And they never did the buy sell agreement. And so then, you know, you're paying me tens of thousands of dollars to go litigate and try and hit, you know, get a judge to say, yeah, that money was to buy that interest when you could have paid me less than that to draft a buy-sell agreement. And you got so much more weight and it's set up properly and it functions the way that.
So you have the operating agreement. When's the right time to create the buy-sell agreement? Like, is it at the same time or is it just at a different time? Or, and what is that? Let's talk about the buy-sell.
Same time.
Okay. So let's talk about the buy-sell agreement. How should that be structured? Obviously there's a lot of different ways, but what's probably the most common for the scenarios that I've given you where it's two, three guys, all equal ownership. What's the best way to handle that?
So the high level pieces of it are how it's going to get funded, how you're going to value the ownership interests. And then, you know, in the case of a bad actor, are there discounts on their ownership interest because they're doing things they shouldn't be doing? And so, that can be a little bit of an administrative burden because hopefully your value is ever increasing. If you are using insurance to fund these things, then, you know, the policy you got on a 40% owner when the company was worth $1 million is not going to cover it when the company is worth 10. So there's definitely some maintenance on that, and the insurance companies will hold your feet to the fire a little bit, but as long as you're paying the premiums on these key man or whatever policies that you're getting, because they're specific buy sell insurance policies, then they don't come and check in on your valuations very often, especially if you've got it built into the buy sell that, hey, every 2 years we're going to come in and either unanimously agree on the value of the company, or we're going to have an independent auditor come in and value the company. And that's a provision in the case of a, you know, death or divorce that usually there's a third party CPA or business valuation expert who's going to say, okay, this is what the company's worth. If there's an insurance policy that covers it, great. If it doesn't cover it, company can basically make the, in the case of a death, make the widow sign a promissory note, and the company will pay monthly or annually or quarterly the buyout, but she's going to transfer that ownership immediately. So, and that's the deal. And the goal of any buy sell is to get the, to keep the company operational without any interference from somebody who's not really invested in the business.
Yeah. I've seen in the partnership in the, at least the two, member, businesses, I've seen a provision where for the buy sell, it's like I've heard it called a candy bar, provision, where essentially like if you and I were splitting a candy bar, I would be the one to split it, but then you get to choose which side you want. And so I should probably make it a fairly equal, right? But but essentially where it's like, hey, you say, hey, I want to try to buy you out. Okay, well, make me an offer. And if you make that offer, I can also buy it at that amount and you don't have any ownership anymore. What would you call that? How does that set up?
So there's transfer restrictions that situation is kind of a little bit different. And forced buyout provisions and stuff like that, those are more complex and really they're not common, candidly, and unless you get into more sophisticated investors being brought in and that sort of thing. But generally speaking, the operating agreements that we have don't have forced buyout provisions. But right of first refusal is very common. And that's, you know, there's always a transfer section in any operating agreement that says this type of transfer is okay. You know, like if you want to move your ownership into a trust that you are the trustee of, that's fine. But any other transfer, you got to give us notice. The company has to have notice. And then whoever you transfer it to is not a member until we say they're a member. But built into that almost always is a right of first refusal for the other members or the company itself. And so there's mechanisms and deadlines and all sorts of stuff built into these operating agreements where you got to give us notice within so many days of receiving an offer from somebody. We've got so many days to decide if we want to buy it at that price. And if we don't, then you can sell it, but you have to close that transaction within so many days so that the company's not in limbo waiting on what, are you an owner or aren't you? The right of first refusal type provisions and are found in those transfer sections and are very common and are important to keep the owners of the company who aren't selling protected from being partners with somebody they don't want to be partners with.
Right.
We've mentioned before, like, you know, if there's a big decision, you take it to a vote or whatever that process is. Can you talk about ownership with voting members and non-voting members? How that plays into it and when you would want to have someone that doesn't have a vote but is still an owner?
Sure. That situation is more in line with what we talked about earlier of kind of having a financial investor who's not involved in the operations of the company and is really just there to loan the company some money, give the capital infusion, and then get some sort of return typically on their investment. But maybe they don't know anything about running whatever business it is that you're running. And so having them have the power to disrupt making decisions on behalf of the company is not feasible. And so the hard part with that, though, is usually people are not willing to give a bunch of money to a company that unless they are going to be able to have some sort of control over it. Bigger investors, it's a little bit different, but or even when you get into higher level investing with individuals is usually when that non-voting interest comes in where, you know, it's my company, I need another $5 million. So you're going out to your friends or and getting out on that branch that can often break and cause problems. But, you know, that's where the non-voting and voting interests come in. Or one that I've seen recently is on a business purchase where there's kind of the owner finance piece to it. That could be the case where the seller owner is still a member, and is being paid out through distributions from the company. They're just not, you know, they've sold the business, so they're not going to be in management anymore. So that's another situation where you can have that voting and non-voting interest where you're both members, you both get K-1s if it's taxed as a partnership. But as far as the operations go, you don't have a say in how the company's run anymore.
And frequently aren't people like that, silent people, afforded some other protections like the president of the company can't take distributions and wipe everybody out? And,
sure.
You know, some kind of controls that are institutionalized in a document.
And some of those are not necessarily institutionalized in the document, but are just part of the law, right? There's fiduciary duties that any owner owes its co-owners. And that's another part of the operating agreement that really needs to be read carefully, because sometimes operating agreements will waive that. And, you know, these managers have no duties. They can compete with the company. They can do whatever they want to, and you can't hold them accountable for it. And so, you know, for the person who's coming in as an investor and reviewing an existing operating agreement, that is for sure one of those provisions that you got to read carefully, because I've seen them where the people who are in charge in the operating agreement, all the investors waive any sort of fiduciary duties owed by those people, any non-compete provisions. They can literally self-deal and take deals for themselves, even if the company was offered the deal. I mean, I've seen some pretty shockingly broad waivers of those sorts of duties that, you know, render your investment just completely at risk.
Right. Hey, two things. I want to talk about one thing that happens all the time. It happens a lot. It's happening right now. Is people want to give some ownership to employees. Okay. Now, I'm not talking ESOPs. I'm talking about this guy's worked and he wants to be an owner. Generally, I'm against that, not because I want to beat up employees, but I will say generally they don't appreciate it. They don't understand. And by that, I don't mean they're not thankful. I mean, they don't appreciate equity as opposed to just money. Sure. And they can do things like you buy a truck out of your private funds or whatever. You come to the company and, well, there's my profit, you know. But if you're doing that, do you know anybody who does that? And one of the provisions I'm always recommended, if somebody does that, they need, and they leave the company, they need to leave their ownership behind, compensated for it. And then you're into valuations and all this stuff. But do you see people giving shares to, or ownership units, whatever they are, to?
I see people who want to do that. And by and large, it's more of a, I want them to have a profit share is really what most of the people who come in asking about that want, more so than I want all our company's losses to be, for them to be able to take that on their taxes.
Well, right? That's the other thing. They never want the employee to pay in anything, you know.
Right.
Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
So we usually, when people approach us about that, propose some sort of assignment of profits rather than a transfer of ownership. And, you know, kind of the exception to that is if you've got somebody who is really integral to the business and you're worried about them potentially leaving and competing with you and really hurting the company in a significant way. If they're a partner, if they're an owner, the Oklahoma's non-competition laws are a lot more enforceable than they are if they're just an employee or an independent contractor.
That was my second thing that I wanted to bring up, non-competes and non-solicits. And you are talking about, I think, the non-compete, but would you catch, what's the difference? One's enforceable, one's not. And if they, if you pay them extra money to buy their non-competition, some things like that, then it is enforceable maybe, as opposed to if you just have them. Okay. If you can talk about those two things.
Yeah. And I don't, just giving them extra money to buy the non-competition is not enough in Oklahoma.
Okay.
And so I don't want to get too far into the legal advice on a podcast situation, right. But the non-competes are very, very difficult to enforce against somebody who's not a partner or not selling their business to you. And by non-compete, that's strictly, I had a framing company. My employee goes out and starts his own framing company. Oklahoma is very much in favor of trade and people being able to engage in the business and their profession. And so non-competes in the strict sense of you're doing the same job over here that you're doing for us are very difficult to enforce with limited exceptions, such as partners or the purchase of goodwill is what it's called. So when you buy a company, non-solicitations, however, are very different. And that those are very enforceable, very much enforced in Oklahoma courts. And that includes solicitation of employees. So you have somebody who leaves and wants to take some of your employees. That's, you would want them to sign non-solicitations. Those are enforceable. Solicitation of clients, solicitation of vendors, all of those sorts of acts and conduct can be prohibited in an operating agreement. And a non-compete in an operating agreement is enforceable because they're your partner. And I don't want to stray too far into employment stuff because that's A, not what we're here to talk about, and B, not really my wheelhouse. But
right,
these non-solicitation, non-compete issues, I have litigated and have drafted agreements for, and every operating agreement that has a partner should have some sort of non-compete and non-solicitation discussion. There are situations where real estate investor A and real estate investor B want to go in on some joint venture real estate deal. Obviously, you're not going to have a non-compete in that situation. What you would have is an obligation not to steal opportunities from the company. So, you know, if somebody approaches the joint venture with an investment opportunity, real estate investor B can't take it without real estate investor A's consent. So the non-competes can be very technical in the operating agreement, and should be. I mean, unless you're starting the business with a partner, in the situations where you're kind of either bringing on somebody later or two existing business owners who are wanting to do something new, you want to have some close eyes and some fine tooth combs going through those sections of the operating agreement for sure.
Man, I think the more I think about operating agreements over and over, I've found myself daydreaming at times in this episode just about, man, if I ever go into business, I've got to talk to an attorney first. There's just like no other way to start. And honestly, for myself, I never even thought about it. I always envisioned if I'm getting into a partnership, let's go to an attorney. But no, like get my own attorney for my partnership. Right. So I think that's a big sticking point for me. And I hope our listeners feel the same way. Any other like last words of advice that you have, Patrick, for any of our listeners about operating agreements, about going into partnerships?
Yeah. I mean, having a group of advisors and not just attorneys, but I recently met with a client and around the table was the banker, the insurance guy, me, and the CPA, and one other professional for that specific industry. And that was something that I thought was incredibly wise on behalf of that client, to really, because he had started a business, had a partner, bought the partner out, grew like crazy, and then got to a point where, you know, he had the foresight and the humility, I guess, to go, I don't know everything I need to know about running a business. And I want the people who are supporting me in these different areas of the business to be in communication with each other. And so I think spending some time, not only on the business itself, but creating that group of people who's going to advise the business, who's going to advise you, because you don't always want necessarily the CPA for the company to be your personal CPA, right? And then introducing those professionals so that they can communicate with each other, because
you got a team,
right? And we can,
it's awesome.
And you don't want to be the central bottleneck for the insurance guy who needs to talk to the attorney to get the operating agreement, or the banker who needs a copy of the operating agreement. You want those communication lines open and flowing as soon as they can, because you're, generally speaking, most business owners are what we call subject matter experts, right? Like, I know how to build a house. I don't know how to be a CPA. I don't know how to be an insurance guy. I don't know how to be an attorney. And so the attorney comes to me, and then I got to go talk to the CPA, and I'm not sure what the CPA just said to me, but I think the attorney's going to know. And so then there's this telephone game where the communication, if those lines were open from the get-go, any of this. And then you're able to sit back and do your job and go build the houses. So that to me has been something that over the years I have seen a few times, and when it's done properly, it is incredibly beneficial. With regard to the operating agreements, they can be long and boring to read, right? And you want, and even for me, I mean, you know, there's a lot of these operating agreements are 40 pages long, and the tax section alone is 10 pages. So it's but they're very important. I mean, one of the biggest lawsuits I had was about real estate, commercial real estate partnership, and whether or not the partner who contributed property, how that contribution of the property was treated versus the guy who was just going to contribute his expertise was one of the main points. And so we spent a lot of time litigating the operating agreement. And so they're very important, as are the, you know, the accompanying documents, the buy-sells, the non-competes, the non-solicitations. Those, the non-competes and non-solicitations get litigated all the time. And the buy sell is really one that you don't want to litigate, because it's always the worst. You know, typically it's in a death situation. And, you know, in that scenario that I was talking about earlier, my client showed up to pay condolences and was met at the door with the widow and her attorney, and the attorney asking him questions the company was making and that sort of thing. And if they had set it up properly at the outset, that wouldn't have ever taken place. The insurance money would have gone to pay for the ownership, and the ownership would have had to have come to the company, and the humanity of that situation, could the grief remained, and the loss and everything that should have played out would have in the natural way, instead of, you know, him coming by and talking to an attorney and then calling me and then having to go file a lawsuit because the insurance policy named the wrong person. So the more work that can be done at the outset, and I get it, right? I'm not ignorant of the expense of what I do. But I can promise that I've seen it incur the expense early on and then had to pay to litigate. And litigation is always more expensive. Always. I mean, you know, Martin's deal theoretically could have ended up that way if it hadn't been that particular issue. Yeah.
Patrick intimidated the guy and he bailed immediately.
That's right. Yeah. Everything about me screams intimidation.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. The guy's going, holy cow.
Yeah. But it's just, you know, it's, and sometimes you can't, right? Sometimes you got to get the company going because you got a contract coming in and you need this company, and that's understandable. But, you know, the advice and the parting words would be to get an operating agreement set up as soon as you can. Certainly if you're bringing on partners, because if you didn't do an operating agreement or you have a single member operating agreement and you're bringing on a partner, 99 times out of 100, that document does not cover everything it needs to cover, and does not protect both people. It's the purpose of the operating agreement is to guide the company and protect its owners as well as the business itself. And so it's worth it if you have a going concern and a business that you want to grow and take into kind of the future and start that curve upward, to have somebody look at it and have somebody give you advice on what the existing document, if you have one, means, where the holes in it are, and then ultimately, you know, if you need to have that one revised or restated, to have that done by a professional who knows what they're doing.
One thing I like to say here too is that willingness to get an operating agreement is a sign that you really believe and you're really treating your business as a business.
Sure.
Up until then, it's a couple of buddies, or, I mean, not everybody, but didn't know about it. But at that point, you're always saying, hey, this is real and I better play real. And another passing thing, your list of the banker and the insurance guy and the lawyer and the CPA and the specialty guy all sitting in a group, that's another thing. I've got a resource on my website called the Advisor and Mentor Checklist. Its biggest value is it's just a list of people. And I would add to it HR people, IT people. But it's all these things that can destroy or make your business that you really don't know anything about. But a lawyer for other issues besides this, just somebody read my construction contract. I mean, I've looked at some of those. And in one of my past companies, we dealt with big cities. And you looked at what they said, and it just said, we don't have to pay you. I mean, that's what my layman mind said. Yeah. We don't have to pay you. And you go, well, what am I supposed to do about this? Well, our answer was not do it.
Right.
But you want to do it. It's a sale.
Well, yeah, the contract price was there.
Just an interesting pass. I don't know if you remember it, but California was bouncing checks. And we had done some work for Los Angeles and deposited their check and it bounced. Do you remember that? First in the 2010s, they were handing out IOUs and things like that.
Well, yeah, we got crazy. One.
But anyway.
Wow. Well, we'll definitely link to that checklist for listeners. I think that board of advisors from all these different areas for a business owner is really helpful. So definitely great insight there. Obviously, go get an operating agreement if you're in a partnership. It's never too late to get one. It is too late sometimes, but you can start today, right? The best time is yesterday, but start today. Even if you've already been operating together, go and get that done. Man, this has been really helpful. Answered a lot of questions that we haven't covered on this podcast. So thank you so much for joining us, Patrick. How can people get in touch with you?
Our website is bml.law. So there Bravo, Michael, Larry.
Boy, yeah. Paulmoreslow.law. Right. bml.law. Okay.
Yeah. So that's where you can get the most information on us. I appreciate you guys having me. This has been fun. I've enjoyed it. I always, lawyers love to talk. So anytime I can do that, I'm happy to. But
thanks for not billing us. We appreciate it.
We don't know you hadn't billed us yet. Oh, well. That didn't say we have to pay it.
Yeah. It's in the mail.
It's in the mail.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Patrick. We hope to have you gone again another time. Thank you.
Would love to. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to The Cashflow Contractor. Check out our website in the show notes or visit thecashflowcontractor.com.